Despite Bureau of Prisons policies barring that placement of convicted sex offenders, a growing number of Democrats are demanding a probe and documents into Maxwell's transfer. Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin said in a letter to Attorney General Pam Bondi, the move has a strong appearance it's attempting to cover up the full extent of the relationship between President Trump and Mr. Epstein. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting for Pacifica Radio.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Materializing Race, Charles W. Mills. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Muzo Mutali. The music in the background is Nabu Kofa by Dorothy Ashby, and we play that commemorating her birthday, which was on August 6th. First, I just want to thank the listeners for supporting Don't Forget the Blues with Clarence the Bluesman Turner today during our summer pledge drive. Also, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank all those who enabled us to go over our goal last week. I'd also like to take this opportunity to thank those who pledged soon after we signed off. And that was Ukanwa of D.C., and she said, keep up the excellent and important work you share with the WPFW listeners. Also, Anonymous of Hyattsville said, WPFW is my mainstay, my lifelong education and support. And Anonymous of Silver Spring is a new member. On the last Wednesday of the Summer Pledge Drive, let us make it two for two in making our goal. Be in solidarity with WPFW in Africa Now. And our goal for this hour is $500. Call 202-588-9739 or visit WPFWFM.org. Go to the Donate Now button. And also you can pledge your support on our Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM, to reach our goal of $500 and go beyond our goal. The theme of WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive, which is from August 3rd to the 16th, is 48 years of centering blackness. We'll commemorate Black August and celebrate not only the freedom fighters, political prisoners, and those who have perished in the struggle for Black liberation, but also the scholars, musicians, and poets whose work has served the Black liberation struggle. There are forces working to erase the contribution and significance of Black people. Your contribution ensures that WPFW is not erased and that voices of Black people throughout the diaspora continue to be platformed here. Be in solidarity with WPFW and Africa Now to build a better world, one broadcast at a time. Again, the number is 202-588-9739 or visit WPFWFM.org, and the Cash App is the $WPFWFM. As we commemorate Black August and centering the WPFW's Summer Pledge Drive theme, and keeping in mind this critical time for the African world, Africa Now goes into its archives featuring a past show with Professor Charles W. Williams. Professor Charles W. Williams, who joined the Ancestors on September 20, 2021, was a distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York Graduate Center. He is the author of numerous books on race and political theory. Here is Africa Now, executive producer and co-host James Pope.
We are currently living in an age where Poverty and disease are big business. In a world where race and class produce and reproduce ways of interacting, this process has found ways to attach itself to our very construction of individual and group realities, therefore entrenching conscious and unconscious acts of racism as being natural and or universal occurrences. We live in a world where racial diversity is misunderstood and often replaced as ideological diversity, a constructed reality where the aspiration of power is imposed on old ideas of identity and reincorporated in new forms of marginalization. This holds true despite any claim of post this or post that that is made by dominant discourse. W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in 1903 in Souls of Black Folk that the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line, the relation of darker to the lighter races of men in Asia and Africa, in America and the islands of the sea. Today, in the 21st century, we are still confronted with this color line, which is exacerbated by the symbiotic relationship with the drive to secure material wealth at rates that often rival the height of the age of imperialism, where the total control of the continent of Africa as well as other resource-rich lands were dominant behavioral expressions of geopolitics. Prophetically, in his later writings, as W.E.B. Du Bois is known to do, expands or situates his conceptualization of the color line into being intimately linked with class formations. In the preface of the 1953 edition of The Souls of Black Folk, Du Bois argued that, "I still think today as yesterday that the color line is a great problem of this century, but today I see more clearly than yesterday that back of the problem of race and color lies a greater problem which both obscures and implements it, and that is the fact that so many civilized persons are willing to live in comfort, even if the price of this is poverty and disease of the majority of their fellow men. And to maintain this privilege, men have waged war until today. War tends to become universal and continuous, and the excuse for this war continues largely to be color and race. Often ignored by the sympathetic democratic rhetoric are the racialized consequences of mass poverty and the cultural displacement integral to the globalizing project of democratization, a euphemism for the unbridled proliferation of capitalism. In our lived experiences, powerful forces seek to reconfigure how race is lived on a daily basis. As old forms of accumulation by dispossession emerge and have increasingly impoverished much of the world's population, it has equally created new forms of political, economic, and social stratification. Within this environment, the meanings of race are constantly reconfiguring itself as various forms of exclusion built upon the consequences of enslavement, colonialism, and imperialism are perpetrated and refined. Today, we will dive deeper into understanding race. What we will hear next is Charles W. Mills describe how race is materialized with the advent of modernity, a European modernity. He argues that capitalism is racialized and white supremacy was interwoven within it from its origins. Dr. Charles Mills was a Caribbean philosopher from Jamaica. He is known for his work in social and political philosophy, particularly in oppositional political theory as centered on class, gender, and race. He was distinguished professor of philosophy at the City University of New York's Graduate Center. He is author of a number of books on race and political theory, including The Racial Contract, Blackness Visible, Essays on Philosophy and Race, and Black Rights, White Wrongs, The Critique of Racial Liberalism. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities of Standing Rock, Venezuela, Gorbis and Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, and Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Enjoy the program.
In case it's a bit puzzling, I'm not saying we should materialize race. I'm saying race is a ready material, and then the question is, how does one theorize this? And how does one theorize this in a framework where it makes sense to say some things are material and some things are not? So this is an attempt to sort of explain, if race is material in the first place, how could it be material? And then how would that be related to materialities of other kinds? Okay. The metaphysics of race is by now a familiar topic in philosophy. Philosophers interested in the subject of race found themselves presented with two main alternatives. Traditional, read racist, old-fashioned biological conceptions of race, racial naturalism, racial realism, racial essentialism, racial biologism, and a nouveau liberal white color blindness, racial eliminativism, that urge we drop the concept from our vocabulary altogether. Either race was natural, or like witches and phlogiston, race did not really exist. Most theorists, the important exceptions being Anthony Appiah and Naomi Zak, chose to reject both alternatives and sought instead to carve out a metaphysical space for race as neither biological nor non-existent, but socio-politically constructed. Indeed, not alas primarily because the work of philosophers whose cultural influence is, I'm afraid, quite marginal, the claim that race is constructed has long since become a cliché. But the consensus in the radical academy on this point conceals deep theoretical divergences on the nature of this construction. Is the construction of race meant to demarcate a contrast with a large number of things that are not constructed? Or is it that everything is constructed, so that race falls uninterestingly into this category simply by virtue of the major premise? And what, in any case, or in these different cases, are the constituents, the building blocks, so to speak, of this construction? Are they discourses, prejudices, culture, performance? How might they be related to different theorists' competing views of the workings of socio-political causality and their different framings of the role of the body? Above all, my primary focus here, can older, now seemingly outdated and perhaps even discredited categories famously associated with the Marxist tradition, categories like materialism, can they illuminate the debate? Does it make sense to think of race as material? If so, how and what insights might this give us into its dynamics? That's introduction. So, beginning review of the Marxist framework, especially for the younger generation, as most people in this room by now, you know, you get old, everybody becomes a younger generation. So an audience for whom this is likely an obsolete paradigm. Okay, so the heyday of Marxist influence in the academy, now long past, materialism was a key term. But with the rise of post-structuralism, it has largely disappeared from socio-political theory, except in the work of some feminist theorists, such as Linda Martin Alcoff. Hey, coincidence, she's here. To whom we will return. Now, though they did not actually use the phrase themselves, this was a later coinage, Marx and Engels basically argued that we should understand society and its members in terms of a social ontology, that this ontology was a materialist one. So their insight was that social structures, specifically class structures, shaped human beings so fundamentally that they created a kind of second nature, transforming them into beings of a particular classed kind. So an ontology was created, a metaphysics of society and the self, which was nonetheless, in contrast to traditional metaphysics, historically variant, in that a different kind of class society would have shaped people differently. And in the projected classless communist society of the future, a radically new socialist man and socialist woman would be born. But the possibility of such epochal future transformations was not supposed to undercut the reality that here and now, the present classed humans were indeed deeply molded by their class membership. So the noun and the adjective in the phrase pull against one another. So both need to be emphasized and the tension maintained. The ontology is social rather than natural, but it is nonetheless an ontology with the corresponding implications of that verb for deep metaphysical shaping. We are what we are in large measure because of social forces, which are contingent and could have been different, but with that said, we still are what we are. Now, what distinguishes Marxism, as emphasized, is a peculiar conception of the social ontology. After all, the notions that humans are fundamentally shaped by the social and their socialization is non-anthropological and sociological commonplace, and one that is axiomatic for postmodernism. Marxism famously claims that its socio-political outlook is materialist, that most previous socio-political thinkers, most saliently their immediate adversaries, Hegel and the young Hegelians, apart from Feuerbach, were idealists. So though the term was not used by Marx, their theory of history came to be known as historical materialism. So materialism for them has at least two senses, though these are not clearly distinguished, and in fact they're often conflated, or it's assumed that one logically follows from the other. The first sense is a sense familiar to us from introductory courses in metaphysics. Materialism as an ontological position that contrasts with other ontological positions such as idealism or dualism. Materialism in this sense claims that the only things that exist are physical entities. There are no souls, no minds outside of the thinking brain, and no God. Marxism is not unique in affirming such a view, and both Marx and Engels saw themselves as part of an older materialist tradition of philosophy that stretches all the way back to ancient Greece. In their opinion, Feuerbach was unique among the young Hegelians in being a materialist, though in their opinion, one who did not follow his premises where they thought they pointed. So that's the first sense, ontological. The second sense is fuzzier, it's harder to pin down. Let's call it materialism in the socio-political sense. Materialism in this sense is not an ontological view in the traditional sense just demarcated. It's a claim or a set of claims about patterns of socio-political causality. And as such, it's relevant for claims about social ontology. Socio-political materialism asserting the following three facts. One, the socio-political system can be differentiated into different elements. Two, some of these elements should be thought of as material and some as ideal. And three, overall patterns of socio-political causality are determined by the material elements. The emphasis on overall, because materialism is not denying that ideal elements have some causal efficaciousness. But the claim is that in terms of shaping the overall socio-political dynamic, the material elements are more important. So in the same way that ontological materialism is supposed to be an important general truth about the universe, socio-political materialism is supposed to be an important general truth about the workings of the social world. So what were these material elements? Well, Marx and Engels seem to have been working with the following analogy. Materialism as an ontological position affirms the general independence of the world from the mental. Though obviously in the case of human institutions, it becomes more complicated. The universe pre-existed us, it pre-existed other thinking beings, it pre-existed all forms of life. So the universe does not depend on us. Moreover, when life and the mental eventually come into existence, they do so as functions of physical structures without which they could not survive. So if this is correct, then dualism is false, idealism is false, and the claim that everything is constructed is false. The vast majority of things in the universe are not constructed. Money is constructed, mountains are not constructed. So this ontological asymmetry is then analogized to a causal asymmetry. Materialism as a socio-political thesis affirms the differential causal significance of a particular social sector, which is analogously independent of us. And the idea is that certain aspects of the social order have the character they do independent of our will. And for Marx and Engels, that's the level of human technological development and the power relations in which production is organized. So the techno-economic is supposed to be independent of our will because without access to the means of production, we would not be able to survive. And because of this material necessity, the necessity of, you know, making a living, a power relationship is established in society by virtue of which the owners of the means of production have differential power over the lives of others. And this asymmetrical significance is metaphorically condensed in the famous metaphor of the base and the superstructure. So the base is supposed to be the forces and relations of production in Marxist jargon, and then the superstructure is supposed to be, you know, the state, the political system, culture, and so forth. And the don't worry, it gets better if you can sort of endure this. It gets better eventually. So class, for Marx and Engels, is therefore supposed to be a more foundational category than any other social group membership. Class is material, part of the base, and the state, the legal system, morality, all of that is ideal. And then finally, the material is not restricted to the base and the force and relations of production. Nature itself is also material because nature is also independent of us. But the claim Marx and Engels make is that you cannot assimilate historical materialism to naturalistic materialism because human beings are distinguished from other animals not by virtue of being created by God and set above the rest of humanity, a worldview that Marx and Engels obviously would have rejected, but by virtue of having our natural capacities, the capacity as human beings to significantly alter the natural world and react back upon it, so that natural causality is increasingly mediated through the social. So Marx and Engels thought that theories of geographical determinism, theories of biological determinism are false because they don't take account of the way in which natural variables are modified and, you know, changed by, you know, the social sector. Okay, that's preface. You're still here. That's great. Let's get to race. So what does all of this, you ask, in fact, I've been asking for a long time, I'm sure, what does all this have to do with race and embodiment, the theme of our conference? So the question I'm asking is, how would those who are sympathetic to Marxism, materialism, and a political economy approach to race? So these are, you know, ancient categories, political economy. We're not talking about Foucault and Derrida and in our discourse, we're talking about old-fashioned political economy. How would those sympathetic to Marxism approach race within such a framework and say, is it possible that the orthodox Marxist representation of race is mistaken, and it's not that class is the only thing that's material, but race could be material too? So at this point, I would like to introduce as a reference point the work of Linda Martin Olkoff, a participant in our conference. In her recent book, Visible Identities, Olkoff stakes out a theoretical position with which I'm in fundamental sympathy. And in a sense, what I'm trying to do here is to develop and extrapolate what I take to be her line of argument. Not, of course, that I expect you would necessarily agree with me in all the claims I'm going to make.
And that is Charles W. Mills. And with me in the virtual studio is Katia Stitz. Katia, how are you doing?
I'm well, Muiza. How are you doing?
Fine, thanks. How are you? I'm actually in the middle of driving in Virginia.
So. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness. Well, we want to, you know, another wonderful produced by you and James Pope. And we want to encourage people to do what they need to do to support that which supports you, to be in solidarity, again, with Africa Now and the fantastic work that they bring to our airwaves. And, of course, both of them doing the work off air in their own rights and then bringing it to the air. So the number to call is 800-222-9739 or wpfwfm.org. We have a goal this hour of $500, and we can do this together, folks. It is a really fascinating listen talking about race and class, and certainly there's no shortage of conversations on these topics these days, but the kind of analysis and insight that the guests of Africa Now bring you I would say, even more necessary and more critical to have, because they're bringing forth the voices of scholars and other experts who have really studied, for instance, the things that they're talking about today, or have been involved in the struggle around some of the topics that they bring forth. So the number to call is 800-222-9739 or wpfwfm.org. And we have $500 to go before we go. I don't know if we go back to that Charles Mills or not.
Yes, we do. We go back to his conversation with a lecture given by him a few years ago. He joined the Ancestors in September 2021. So we're going back to the archives. We presented this as a memoriam at that time in September 2021. And we're going back to the archives for that session. We've had him on before as well, before that. But we thought it would be very important to have this conversation as we're facing these issues right now. And then also because of Black August. And in the spirit of the WPFW's mission and its theme for this summer fund drive, which is making sure that we African people's histories are not erased. And when we say African peoples, we're talking about all of the African world, whether you're in the continent or in the diaspora.
Exactly, and we see that here, both here in D.C. or in this country, as well as throughout the diaspora, Black people being under attack. And so, again, these words are timely, they're critical, they're instructive, and we ask you to pledge your support for this program. $500 to go, 800-222-9739, or WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect. And you can also, if it's easier, you're on your phone, you can always do texting WPFWFM to 801-801.
And there's also Cash App, which is the $ WPFWFM. Cash App is the $ WPFWFM. And hopefully we can do two for two. We were able to reach the goal and the beyond. And this is our last Wednesday. So for those folks who missed the opportunity last week, this is the last time for this summer pledge drive to be in solidarity with WPFW in Africa Now.
That's right. So take advantage of it. This is your last opportunity to support that which supports you in the form of Africa Now and the great work that Mwiza Mutale and James Pope do. $500, 800-222-9739. And you might be just the type of listener that's interested in picking up the downloadable Black August, Black Liberation Digipack. That can be yours for a pledge of $150 that is completely downloadable. It is there for you to share with your friends, family, neighbors, you know, to start discussions about Black liberation, about struggle, about resistance, all of these important concepts. And it features the voices of, the voices of George Jackson and the Soledad brothers. H. Rep. Brown is there. Kathleen Cleaver, Eldridge Cleaver are both there. We have Mumia Abu-Jamal. We have June Jordan, Sun Ra, because we're also lifting up those poets and musicians that also furthered the Black liberation struggle. And we have James Baldwin, we have John Coltrane, Odetta, so much more. So that can be yours for a pledge of $150. And if we get three of those, is my math correct? No, four of those, Mwiza, we will be golden.
Yeah. Is there 150? Right. Yeah, four of those that will be.
Four of those.
And then I think maybe we'll go back to Charles W. Mills to inspire people to get those. I think that it's very much connected to that.
Perfect.
Thank you. And we're going to go back to that conversation. But,
for Linda, too, is trying to recuperate materialism for race and gender identities. So in the book, we find her rejecting Orthodox Marxism's dismissal of identity politics while simultaneously affirming the importance of Marxist class categories and the need to recognize that, quote, capitalism was a racial and gender system from its inception, so that the real challenge that identity politics must address is a need to articulate its precise relation to class, end quote. She's hostile, as virtually all feminist philosophers are, to a biologistic naturalism about gender, while simultaneously, as significantly fewer do, warning that, quote, post-structuralism threatened to deconstruct the feminist subject as well as the female subject, and rejecting Judith Butler's view that all is culture and performance. She repudiates, along with virtually everybody else, a class reductivist or naturalist materialism, while simultaneously, along with a smaller number of us, being emphatic on the need to reconstruct a new materialism that is not theoretically handicapped in these ways, which in the case of gender would be, quote, an analysis that maintains the central importance of the material reality of the sexed body. In sum, gender is both positional and material, end quote. So Linda is in agreement with classical Marxism and hostile to post-structuralist feminism on the importance of the material ideal distinction while rejecting classical Marxism's restriction of materiality to class. Unlike those theorists who would say that material is either false, since in fact it is discourse that determines everything, or meaningless, since this binary opposition, idealism versus materialism, is an artifact of a conceptual framework that needs to be transcended and abandoned, Linda wants to insist that materialism is meaningful and true. So the question I want to ask then is, what about race? Linda's self-consciously materialist counter-theorization of identity politics in her book, and what you could also call identity metaphysics, is focused more on gender than on race. But she does say in her chapter on mixed race that, quote, any materialist account of the self must take race into account, close quote. So clearly she endorses such a project in principle. But the question then is, what would a distinctively materialist constructivism look like? How do we theorize the social constructiveness of race in a theory which prioritizes material determinants as its crucial shaping factors? And relatedly, how should we understand the materiality of race, if it is indeed material, in relation to these other materialities? Okay, so that's our preface, and let's now go into the attempt to do it. Okay, so first of all, to preempt some obvious misunderstandings, as we just emphasized, it's not an argument for race in the naturalistic sense. It's not that kind of materialism. So we're not saying that race represents natural biological limitations, evolutionary laws, and is material in that sense. That's traditional racist theory. We're rejecting that. It's not that kind of materialism. That's in a Marxist framework that would count as unhistorical materialism. That's naturalistic materialism. Whereas, as I emphasized, the idea is that you want a materialism that is sensitive to history. So one's blackness would not be a transhistorical fact. It's not the case that your blackness sort of, you know, endures over time and has these effects as a sort of natural relation between you and other human beings. Blackness is a socio-historical contingent fact rather than one that's, you know, eternal throughout history. So the whole point of the Marxist critique is that our embodied experience is intimately related to the larger social body of the body politic. And this, of course, you know, picks up on Gale's point, not that particular vocabulary, but the idea of intercorporeality, bodies, the materiality of bodies related to other bodies, and so forth. Now, Marx was not concerned about race, except, of course, from occasional racist comments about niggers. But his discussion about alienation makes it clear that our relation to the ourselves, our relation to the world, is determined by class society. So if you think of the early manuscripts, the 1844 manuscripts and the concepts there, alienation from your product, from others, from our species being, from the world, that's not intrinsic to the human condition as such. That's not a manifestation simply of the externalization of our activity in the world, because then we're an unavoidable feature of all societies. What Marx is emphatic on is that this is a consequence of the emergence of class society, as a result of which you are a relation of domination to what he called the ruling class. So this obviously provides us with an overall theoretical orientation. If you want to theorize race as material, we need to see race somehow the same way. But we're disadvantaged. We're disadvantaged looking at the Marxist text because Marx himself did not recognize white supremacy as a system in itself. He recognized class domination as a system in itself. He did not recognize racial domination as a system. So if we look at one of the most famous treatments of black embodiment in the literature, Fanon's Black Skin, White Mass, which has already been cited here, what does he emphasize in his introduction? He says, he does not come with timeless truths. He's diagnosing a phenomenon of a particular historical specificity arising out of the history of colonialism, and the quote is, the architecture of this work is rooted in the temporal. So the reason the black body has the significance it does is because of a particular sequence of historical events by virtue of which the black body becomes located in a larger body politic within which race has significance, as against a previous body politic where it did not. And the conventional judgment, which, you know, most theorists of race agree upon, is that race is a product of modernity. You do not have race in the ancient world. You do not have race in the medieval world. Race is a modern phenomenon. So blackness is then, he doesn't use these words, blackness is a result of a social ontology. And, you know, the question then is, can we use the work of Fanon and other people in the sort of tradition that leads up to critical race theory to sort of see how you could conceive of race in material terms? Okay, why doesn't Marxism want to recognize race as material? I suggest it could be seen as a particular, a distinctively Marxist version of the overall position of racial eliminativism. So there's mainstream liberal racial eliminativism. I suggest there's also a Marxist variant thereof. Marxists would concede that racism exists, but would deny that race as such has any social reality. What races really are related to the metaphysics of class. For example, they're subordinated national minorities, they're sub-proletarianized sections of the working class, they're not ontological entities in themselves.
So in terms of the same orthodox Marxist metaphor based on superstructure, race is located at the superstructural level. At the level of the base, what you have are classes, and then the role of racism as an ideology is to rationalize super exploitation. So all class societies are sort of structured by exploitation. In the case of race, you have super exploitation. You're not talking about the exploitation of the white working class, not talking about wage labor. You're talking, for example, about slave labor. You're talking about, you know, sort of, you know, pre-modern kinds of production, which are nonetheless articulated to modern relations of production. So you have relations of exploitation different from the kind of exploitation that the white working class is subject to. But the material base that's composed of classes and class fractions. And in that same text, you know, by Fanon, we have his famous critique of Sartre, because he says Sartre is sort of assimilating the history of race to this larger Hegelian Marxist dialectic. So, you know, there's this, well, in sort of, you know, a somewhat misleading reduction, but, you know, thesis, antithesis, and that's where racism comes out. So there's racism, there's what he called anti-racist, racism and negritude, and then you transcend the whole thing in sort of glorious socialist revolution. So the problem with the Marxist categories is that they point us in the right direction, that the body has related to the body politic, but by depriving us of the sort of overall theoretical framework that would recognize race as a social structure in itself, they basically block our understanding. So the only system that's recognized is capitalism as class society. So the material is exhausted by class. The main kind of social group, classes, class relations of production as the material girders of the structure, class exploitation is central, and class interests as the material interests, the struggle over which is the main historical dynamic. And the claim would be you cannot conceptualize race this way. Why? Because the white working class are basically just victims of capitalist ideology. So they're represented as being misled by bourgeois ideology in the service of capitalist interests into thinking of themselves as white, but their true class interests are in terms of realizing this non-racial socialist order. They are not recognized as having racial interests. Class interests are recognized. It is denied that they could have racial interests. Class exploitation is recognized. Racial exploitation is not recognized. So overall, you get a particular model of society which is structured around class and which sort of limits race, as I said, to the ideological level, to the level of racism. Superstructural stuff, not stuff at the material level. So what do you need to do in response? If on the one hand you're sympathetic to a Marxist approach in terms of political economy, on the other hand you're frustrated by official Marxism, clearly the thing to do is to recognize white supremacy as a system in itself analogous to class domination, structured by exploitative relations between races and thereby constituting racial interests. So you then recognize that races are real and that the white working class do have racial interests as well as class interests. These interests are multidimensional. Social status, differential political input, cultural hegemony, somatic normativity, but at their core, arguably, material interests. And again, this is anathema, this is heretical within an orthodox Marxist framework, because clearly the white working class, their only material interests are class interests. How could they have material racial interests? And the great advantage of the huge amount of work producing critical race theory and critical white studies over the past 20 years or so is that, you know, you now have a literature on race and, you know, money and wealth, which is far more theoretically sophisticated than the previous body of work. And a crucial text is a book that I'm sure many of you know by Melvin Olive and Thomas Shapiro, Black Wealth, White Wealth, which came out in 95. And they argued that the mistake people have been making all along in looking at prospects for racial equality were focusing narrow-mindedly on differences in median household incomes. So you look at the median white household, look at the median black household. You say, for example, the median black household is making 50%, let's say in the 1940s. And then they're gradually inching upwards, 60%, 70%, they're making progress, blah, blah, blah. And what you need to look at is not just income, you need to look at wealth. If you look at wealth, you find a far more illuminating metric for long-term prognosis of the prospect of racial equality. Why? Because it's a capitalist country. The same thing that Marxists recognize, it applies to race. In a capitalist country, wealth is crucial. I mean, in a world where privileged white people, you know, professionals have been laid off working at McDonald's, you suddenly realize wealth is crucial at all levels. Wealth provides a cushion against medical catastrophe, can be used to start a small business, can be used to make a down payment on a mortgage, can be transmitted as an inheritance to your kids to give them a head start in life. And the differentials in wealth between white and black households, they dwarf income differentials. The median white household has 10 times the wealth of the median black household. And you might think, well, okay, even if that's true, that's because it's being skewed by the multi-millions of the white elite at the top. Not true. If you look at 2004 statistics, if you look at the bottom quintile, that's the bottom fifth of the white population, and the bottom quintile of the black population, the median white household, white quintile at the bottom, black household at the bottom, the difference is in wealth 400 times. The bottom fifth of the white population, the median, has 400 times the wealth of the bottom fifth of the black population. So it's not just a difference that's at middle class and upper class levels. The difference in ratios, not in absolute numbers, of course, but the difference in ratio is actually largest at the working class level. So what's the point of the critique? The critique is not that class is not material. It's not that the white working class are not exploited. The critique is that capitalism as it develops in the modern world is generally racialized, so that a kind of pure abstract capitalism, or you know, the capitalism of, you know, Britain that Marx was analyzing in Capital, it was a racial system to which he had, there's stuff about the Irish and, you know, some fleeting remarks about colonialism and India and slavery. But basically, the racial dimension that capitalism was not faced. So that white supremacy as a system of advantage and disadvantage interlocks with capitalism from the start, and it means that white workers are both the victims of capitalist exploitation and they are the beneficiaries of racial exploitation. So the materiality of race can be cashed out, and this of course is an appropriate metaphor here, in terms of differential probabilities of material advantage and disadvantage for whites and people of color. Segregation, racial division of labor, job and housing discrimination, all these factors mean that a white worker has a better chance in society of getting ahead than a person of color. So it means that on this straightforward level, race is material in terms of differential probabilities of material success. You have to put it in terms of probability, because it's certainly not the case that, you know, every white worker is rich. I mean, obviously, that's completely false. You're basically talking about expectations and life chances. And that's material in terms of what it links up with, you know, the possibilities of wealth, the possibilities of a good life for yourself and your children and so forth.
And again, that is the voice of Charles Mills, and the program is Africa Now, and we ask you to invest in that which supports you. That is imperative in these perilous times for all media, but especially public media, and more specifically, political public media that tries to lift up these varied voices, voices that are often marginalized and silenced by legacy media. WPFW does not do that. And Africa Now, in terms of centering the African continent and the diaspora, has always ensured that we are availed of these critical thinkers and historians and anthropologists and others, artists, you know, and others that we need to know about and we need to hear from. So if you understand that what Africa Now does is a critical part of what WPFW's mission is, then please give a call right now, 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect. We still need someone to get us started. We have 17 minutes to go and $500 to go. We have more of that talk to go to, but we really need to take a moment and ask you to support that which supports you. This is your last opportunity to support Africa Now and the great work, the incredible work, actually, that Mwiza Muntali and James Pope do off air. They bring to the airwaves of WPFW so that we can be educated, enlightened, inspired, so that we can engage in critical thinking on these issues that they bring forth, and follow and understand the work of the voices that you hear on Africa Now. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect. Mike, I believe we have another, Muiza has left us for a moment. Mike, I believe we have another segment to go, if I'm not mistaken. So let us go back to that. I don't want to run out of time so you don't end up hearing the entire wonderful show that they have assembled for us. But I do want you to go to the phones and pledge your support for the good work that Muiza and James Pope bring forth every week. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org. $500 to go. I hope I have a few minutes at the end to thank you for stepping up.
Okay, so there's race as material in that sense. So let's now turn to another sense. So that sense is relatively uncontroversial. This sense is going to be more controversial. So again, let's return to Linda's work. In a section of chapter 6 of her book called Is Sex Like Race, she points out a crucial difference between race and sex. There is no racial entity or physiological structure corresponding to the variable of reproductive role. And here I quote, "Gender identities in some variation seem to be, unlike race, historically ubiquitous, hardly recent, and based on a set of biological features with more morphological substance than biologically insignificant physical attributes such as skin color, the shape of the nose or eyes, or hair type," end quote. So gender is far older than race. Gender is embedded in the history of the species much more deeply than race. So Linda observes, "In regard to race, it makes much more sense to look at the global political economy and the history of colonialism for an understanding of why and how skin shades gained such ontological significance in recent centuries," end quote. So she talks about political economy, she also talks about ontological significance, and the question then is, how do you sort of focus on the distinctive political economy of race and link that to these broader materialities of gender and class? So here's the approach I'm going to take. So again, for the, not that necessarily want to identify themselves as such, for the older among us, shall I say, not old, for the older in the audience, some people here at least will remember socialist feminism. Hands up, no, I won't ask that embarrassing question. Okay, so some people, without asking them to identify themselves, remember socialist feminism. So this was before the rise of post-structuralism, when Marxism was still seen as a live option. So what did socialist feminists say? They said that Marxist feminism, which is not the same for them as socialist feminism, Marxist feminism, sort of orthodox Engelsian feminist theory, and Engels has his famous book, The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, all kinds of deficiencies, nonetheless give him credit, major political thinker, one of the very few in the history of the Western tradition to write anything on gender, so you know, give him credit for writing that book. So Marxist feminists were identified as those who accepted the orthodox Engelsian analysis, and they were what were also called radical feminists, who said there's a whole lot of gender subordination which is not captured by these categories in terms of rape, pornography, prostitution, and so forth. Socialist feminists said, let's bring these two bodies of theory together. So you'll reinforce the strengths of both and you'll correct for the weaknesses. And what you'll do, you'll try to theorize gender as material. So in the same sense that class is supposed to be part of the relations of production, gender is part of the relations of reproduction. So the materiality of class inheres in the fact that we need to appropriate the world to survive. The materiality of gender inheres in the fact that you need reproduction for the human race to survive. Women are the ones capable of having children. This doesn't mean that women are the ones who should raise the children, but this is a biological fact about women, the biological and material fact upon which sociopolitical materiality then builds. So male power then means that you then get a gender system organized around subordination of women, rationalized by the claim that since women are the ones who have the children, they're the ones who should raise the children. Okay, so you then get what socialist feminists called a dual systems theory. And that theory was that you need to theorize capitalism as capitalist patriarchy. So patriarchy is male domination, and the particular kind of male domination in the modern period intersects with capitalism, so it's a system of both class and gender. Okay, so from my perspective, obviously, you know, this is great stuff, but it needs to be supplemented.
You can't talk about a dual system. You need to talk about a triple system. You need to sort of incorporate race into these interlocking systems. But the problem then is, as Linda's quote points out, what is it in race that corresponds to the biological specificity in these other materialities? In the case of class, it's the material fact that as material beings, we need to eat to survive, we need to appropriate nature. If somebody else owns the means of production, we can't access them without that person, then we're in a power relation with respect to them. In the case of gender, it has to do with the fact that it's only half of the human race that has the genitalia that enables them to be one to bear the children, so you then get a system of patriarchy erected on that fact. But in the case of race, there's nothing inherent about skin color, facial features, hair texture that is linked up with the body in such a way as a class materiality is, as a gender materiality is. So in other words, even without class ideology, it will still be the case that we need to eat to survive. That's not a bourgeois fact. That's a fact. As material beings, we need to eat to survive. We need to sort of match our needs in all kinds of ways. Even without gender ideology, it would be the case that women are the ones who bear the children. That's not an artifact of sexist ideology. That's a biological fact about the human species. There's nothing in race that corresponds to that. It's not the case that you can say, even without racist ideology, blah, 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 blah. Racial biological differentiation is completely superficial. There's nothing in it that has the deep significance of the human need to, you know, eat, get shelter, blah, blah, to survive, or the fact that women are the ones who have kids. So the challenge that is then posed is, what could it be that could make race material, given that there's nothing in the raced body that corresponds to this? And that's why you can see why the orthodox Marxist challenge has its plausibility. The orthodox Marxist will say, look, there's nothing to play the role of the relations of reproduction in the case of race. If you want to talk about slave labor, then you can just talk about that as in a particular kind of labor formation. So there's in a free wage labor, there's slave labor. Those are class categories. If you want to talk about black workers not getting a fair chance at jobs in the capitalist market after emancipation, that's sub-proletarianized sections of the working class. Those aren't racial categories, those are class categories. So the claim would be that to the extent that race exists, it's just class in a different skin. So the challenge then is, if you want to sort of say, well, as orthodox Marxists, you're wrong, what could you point to say, well, you know, this is how race is material? So my argument is going to be that we can develop the category of personhood in such a way that its material dimension is revealed, and that relations of personhood slash subpersonhood could play the role for race of these other kinds of material factors, and would sort of complement the relations of production of orthodox Marxism, the relations of reproduction of socialist feminism. You'd also have, in addition to those two,
And again, we hate to interrupt this conversation. We've also been having problems again still with our transmitter, but our engineers are working tirelessly to work it out. This is why supporting WPFW is so critical. So if you are able to hear us and you are able to support, now is the time to do it. We want to thank Gary Nelson out of Baltimore picking up that downloadable Black August, Black Liberation Digipack. Thank you so much. And if I had three more people doing that within the next 8 minutes, we would be golden. So we have 350 to go. We can do it together, folks. 800-222-9739. 800-222-9739. That is a byproduct of talking so much today. Forgive us. Freedom is not free. And if you want to hear voices, and specifically voices that either are coming out of the African-American or the African diasporic realm, if you want to hear voices centering the work of Black people, now is the time to step up. In this great time of erasure, in this great time of occupation of Black people, and now I can say this here in DC, right? And he wants to move it to every center, Trump does, every center where there is a concentration of Black people, every city where there's a concentration of Black people, this cannot happen. One way to fight back is to ensure that a media outlet that centers Black voices on the regular, not as not during Black History Month or as an anomaly, but on the regular, please do what you can to support now, because there might not be a later. 800-222-9739. If you appreciated all that Charles Mills imparted today, it was a riveting discussion that he was giving, or rather a talk that he was offering us, a lot there to instruct us, a lot there to study, which is what we need to be doing right now, then please go to the phones and pledge your support. If you understand the importance of all that Africa Now brings us every week in terms of ensuring that we know what's happening, not only here in America around African Americans, but throughout the diaspora, and especially what's going on the continent, pledge right now. 800-222-9739, WPFWFM.org, $350 to go. We'll leave you now. Zain El Amin and Shewa Nana are up next, or is up next, right after our headline news. But please keep the call coming. Keep the calls coming. And we will see you on the other side, and hopefully be able to thank you on the other side.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. In Gaza, 8 more Palestinians have starved to death, including 3 children in the last 24 hours, and Israeli attacks have killed at least 65 Palestinians, including 25 aid seekers, since dawn today. The death toll of starvation now at 235, nearly half are children, about 100, according to the group Save Our Children. The World Food Program says starvation and malnutrition are at the highest levels in Gaza since the conflict began. Meanwhile, Israel's in talks to possibly resettle Palestinians from Gaza to South Sudan. If implemented, that would amount to transferring people from one war-ravaged land facing famine to another. Israel has floated similar resettlement proposals with other African nations, including Somalia, and what critics have warned will be ethnic cleansing. Today, Israel's foreign minister told a group of Western journalists it's hosting, Israel will not allow a Palestinian state. France, Canada, the United Kingdom, Portugal, Australia, and New Zealand have all said they will recognize the state of Palestine next month. Meanwhile, efforts to revive ceasefire talks have resumed after apparently breaking down last month. Hamas and Egyptian officials met today in Cairo. European leaders are to speak with President Donald Trump today ahead of his Friday summit with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was in Berlin today for talks with Germany's Chancellor and virtual meetings with European leaders. Zelensky's due to meet with Europeans first and then have a call with President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance about an hour later. Leaders of the Coalition of the Willing, the nations that would help police any future peace agreement, will take place last. At the nation's capital, hundreds of National Guard troops have descended onto the city of Washington, D.C. and made arrests as the Trump administration's vowing to crack down on crime and homelessness. Christopher Martinez has more.
White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt gave an update at her daily press briefing Tuesday.
Approximately 850 officers and agents were surged across the city. They made a total of 23 arrests, including multiple other contacts.
In addition to arresting criminals, Leavitt says, we also want to make D.C. safe and beautiful. And she says that means removing homeless encampments.
So homeless individuals will be given the option to leave their encampment, to be taken to a homeless shelter, to be offered addiction or mental health services. And if they refuse, they will be susceptible to fines or to jail time.
Opponents of Trump's action point out that crime in D.C. is at a 30-year low. The action in Washington and the possibility of similar actions elsewhere have sparked opposition. Jesse Rabinowitz is with the National Homelessness Law Center. He spoke at a rally in Washington, D.C.
Locking up people you don't like or don't want to see is textbook authoritarianism. Trump is testing opinion by focusing on groups that he believes to have little public sympathy, like folks who live outside. Right now, they are coming for homeless folks, trans folks, and migrants. But rest assured, soon they will come for everyone who is not a white, straight, cis, wealthy Christian man.
Some see racial overtones. The places where Trump has sent the National Guard so far, Los Angeles and District of Columbia, both have mayors who are African-American women. Trump repeated old comments Monday about some of the nation's largest cities, including Baltimore, Chicago, Los Angeles, Oakland, and his hometown of New York City, all currently run by black mayors. I'm Christopher Martinez.
As President Donald Trump talks tough on crime at the nation's capital, child sex abuser Jeffrey Epstein's ex-girlfriend Ghislaine Maxwell, who was convicted of sex trafficking for helping Epstein procure underage girls to abuse, was given approval for work release. This comes after Trump's Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, his former personal attorney, met with Maxwell in a federal prison, and she was then moved to low security, despite Bureau of Prisons policies barring that placement of convicted sex offenders. A growing number of Democrats